You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
Welcome to the middle of Christmastide and the season between Christmas and Epiphany, also known as the 12 days of Christmas. Starts with the celebrating of Jesus' birth and wraps up with today's story from Matthew. So, just as an orienting warm-up question, how many kings followed the star to the manger in Bethlehem? The answer? None. According to the text, Jesus' visitors from the east are magi, technically a title for Zoroastrian priests, but in Greek usage, the magi literally means magician or astrologers. The same word is translated as sorcerer in Acts 13. Matthew's magi were not commonly portrayed as kings until the 13th century, inspired by a creative tie-in with Psalm 72, and then immortalized for Americans in Reverend John Hopkins' Christmas carol, We Three Kings, written in 1857. Matthew's imagery follows the Greco-Roman notion that magi were dream-interpreting astrologer-astronomers from Persia or Mesopotamia who possessed secret knowledge of the occult, magi and magic being etymologically related. For Matthew, they are probably stand-ins for pagans in general, but pagans that are respected by Matthew's primarily Jewish audience. The gifts are interesting. Matthew offers them as proof of the pagans' belief that Jesus was royalty of some sort. They've come to be interpreted as foreshadowing, portents of what Jesus' life was going to entail and mean. And especially in Matthew's gospel, one directed at a predominantly Jewish community, it would have been A, incredibly shocking to portray pagans as the one who recognized Jesus first, and B, incredibly satisfying to see the evil Herod fooled by these same pagans. I remember when I was younger being perplexed by the geography and astronomy of this whole story. First, you usually hear that the Magi followed the star in the east, and yet for the story to work, they would have had to travel west from Persia. Peterson helps that confusion in his version when he says that they followed the same star as they saw in the eastern skies or from the eastern skies. Also, they didn't literally follow a star hovering over Bethlehem. Stars don't do that. Note that the Magi interpret some astrological event as an announcement event. They get as far as Jerusalem and have to get more information before they can narrow things down to Bethlehem. It's metaphor on top of metaphor on top of metaphor here. So, in preparation for Epiphany later this week, let's make room to welcome the wise guys that their friends call Balthazar, Melchior, and Caspar.
Our words of wisdom are from Matthew chapter 2, verses 1 through 12. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem village, Judah territory, this was during Herod's kingship, a band of scholars arrived in Jerusalem from the east. They asked around,
"Where can we find and pay homage to the newborn king of the Jews? We observed a star in the eastern sky that signaled his birth. We're on pilgrimage to worship him."
When word of their inquiry got to Herod, he was terrified, and not Herod alone, but most of Jerusalem as well. Herod lost no time. He gathered all the high priests and religion scholars in the city together and asked, "Where is the Messiah supposed to be born?"
They told him, "Bethlehem, Judah territory. The prophet Micah wrote it plainly. It's you, Bethlehem, in Judah's land, no longer bringing up the rear. From you will come the leader who will shepherd rule my people, my Israel."
Herod then arranged a secret meeting with the scholars from the East. Pretending to be as devout as they were, he got them to tell him exactly when the birth announcement star appeared. Then he told them the prophecy about Bethlehem and said,
"Go find this child. Leave no stone unturned. As soon as you find him, send word, and I'll join you at once in your worship."
Instructed by the king, they set off. Then the star appeared again, the same star they had seen in the eastern skies. It led them on until it hovered over the place of the child. They could hardly contain themselves. They were in the right place. They had arrived at the right time.
They entered the house and saw the child in the arms of Mary, his mother. Overcome, they kneeled and worshiped him. Then they opened their luggage and presented gifts, gold, frankincense, and myrrh.
In a dream, they were warned not to report back to Herod. So they worked out another route, left the territory without being seen, and returned to their own country. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
You've heard the story about the folks traveling through a small southern town, and they come across a live nativity scene that had obviously been put together with much thoughtfulness and sincerity. One aspect of it bothered them, though. The three wise men were all wearing firefighters' helmets, totally stumped for a reason and unwilling to interrupt anyone's awe for an explanation, they left. At a convenience store down the block, they asked the lady behind the counter about the helmets. She harumphed and said, "You darn Yankees, never do read the Bible." They assured her that they did, but simply couldn't remember anything about firefighters in the Bible. She jerked her Bible from behind the counter and ruffled through some of the pages and finally jabbed her finger at a passage. Sticking it in their face, she said, "See, it says right here, the three wise men came from afar." Yeah. One of the questions often asked of me at Christmas time is, why gold? Why myrrh? And franken what? The bottom line is that all three gifts were expensive tributes to royalty, and Matthew used them to show just how impressed pagans were with Jesus as the King of the Jews. As time passed, people claimed the gifts were Matthew's way of foreshadowing events in Jesus' life. Plus, because there were three gifts, every nativity scene you see will have three wise men. Even though an obscure Syriac manuscript in the Vatican Library called The Revelation of the Magi, not published in English until 2010, recounts the story of 12 magi and their journey from a remote kingdom that seems to be, are you ready? China. So prepare to update your nativity sets. And not to leave out the obvious, this is a story rife with political implications. The magi were representatives of pagan and foreign influence. And Matthew was basically saying, hey, a bunch of foreigners understand who Jesus is before you guys. And of course, the other thing nobody talks about is that for guys who are supposed to be pretty smart, the wise guys sure act stupid. They go to the current King of the Jews and say, excuse us, we heard that your replacement king was just born somewhere around here. Would you mind giving us some directions? Wow. Which, of course, leads to Herod ordering all the male babies in Bethlehem to be killed, according to the story. You may not realize it, but even today, this story is causing a huge political and societal tidal wave. Did you hear Volodymyr Zelensky's speech before Congress? What did you make of this Jewish president saying, "In 3 days, we celebrate Christmas"? So what? Because up until this year, Ukraine has always celebrated Christmas with Russian Orthodox Christians on what we in the West call Epiphany, January 6th. Ukrainians intentionally celebrating Christmas on December 25th is a huge political snub to Russia, saying, "We choose the West." Ukrainians are saying, "You can no longer claim cultural hegemony over us." So it's not a war on Christmas. It's using Christmas as a psychological weapon in war. So yes, if you take them for the metaphors they are, I think these stories still have relevance today. And as we get ready for Epiphany, I thought it might be a good exercise to revisit not just the date, but the gifts we always hear about, but seldom think about. The first one is gold. For Matthew, gold was probably meant as a symbol of purity and divinity. For generations, the Magi's gift of gold has been interpreted as their having recognized Jesus' royalty. But today, depending on its context, gold is often seen as a garish symbol of tackiness. And no matter how you look at it, it's still just a thing. In the end, it's not as valuable as honest, rich relationships. William Sloan Coffin was for years the renowned pastor of Riverside Church in New York City. Pastor to thousands, doling out advice on how to live the Christian life. In December 1982, his 21-year-old son was driving with a friend. He was rested and stone-cold sober, and yet inexplicably drove off a bridge and was killed. The family was racked with grief, and as sometimes happens, the strain was too much for Coffin and his wife, and they were soon divorced. Months passed. During the summer, a rabbi friend was visiting from out of town and met Coffin for conversation. The rabbi said, "I understand you've suffered a terrible ordeal. First young Bill's death and then your divorce. I didn't know. You should have called." "But I have my faith," Coffin responded. "I could have helped," the rabbi replied. "God has been my source of strength. I've had faith," Coffin continued. "But I could have helped," said his rabbi friend. "You Christians, you're so egotistical. Why do you think God put us here if not to be present for each other in time of need?" Bingo. We try so hard to be rugged individualists, to be independent from others like it's some sort of virtue. But total independence is futile. And that's the gold standard Jesus sets for us. He had his times apart to recharge, but for the most part, he did his life's work in the midst of community, an interdependent group that brought their own gifts to the mission. We need to set our sights on being more interconnected, not independent. Honest, supportive community is worth way more than its weight in gold. And then there's this frankincense, normally a symbol of holiness, otherworldliness, and it's come to represent the Magi's recognition of Jesus' priestly role, but perhaps it's better brought down to earth for this day and age. Stephen Covey, author of the bestseller, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, relates a story from when he was on a subway in New York one Sunday morning. He recalls, people were sitting quietly, some reading newspapers, some lost in thought, some resting with their eyes closed. It was a calm and peaceful scene. Suddenly, a man and his children entered the subway car. The children were so loud and rambunctious that instantly the whole climate changed. The man sat down next to me and closed his eyes, apparently oblivious to the whole situation. The children were yelling back and forth, throwing things, even grabbing at people's papers. It was very disturbing, and yet the man next to me did nothing. It was difficult not to feel irritated. I couldn't believe that he could be so insensitive as let his children run wild like that and do nothing about it, taking no responsibility at all. It was easy to see that everyone else on the subway felt irritated too. So finally, with what I felt was unusual patience and restraint, I turned to him and I said, "Sir, your children are really disturbing a lot of people. I wonder if you couldn't control them a little more." The man lifted his gaze as if to come to a consciousness of the situation for the first time and said softly, "Oh, you're right. I guess I should do something about it. We just came from the hospital where their mother died about an hour ago. I don't know what to think, and I guess they don't know how to handle it either." Covey asks, "Can you imagine how I felt at that moment?" His understanding shifted. He said, "Suddenly, I saw things differently. And because I saw differently, I thought differently. I felt differently. I behaved differently. My irritation vanished. My heart was filled with the man's pain. Feelings of sympathy and compassion flowed freely." Your wife just died? "Ah, I am so sorry. Can you tell me about it? What can I do to help?" Everything changed in an instant. T.S. Eliot wrote, "There is always something we're ignorant of about another person, and often it turns out that the one thing we're ignorant of about another person is the most important." Instead of being quick to draw conclusions, quick to let prejudices taint our understanding, quick to judge and slow to understand, we can strive to know the other. Something like incense serves to heighten our awareness. When we walk into a place with incense, we either think, "What is someone trying to hide?" or we pause. The smell of incense causing all our other senses to perk up, to be hyper aware. So let the thought of incense, of frankincense, be our reminder to heighten our awareness, our understanding, the concerns of those around us. And finally, myrrh. It's a tree resin that was used as an analgesic, in oil for anointing, and for embalming, which is the interpretation many point to as a foreshadowing of Jesus' death. And maybe it's kind of a grim thing to think about at the beginning of the new year, but guess what? We're all going to die. We fill our lives with superficiality to distract ourselves, and before we know it, death sneaks up on us. "Whoa, wait, I am not ready." Then, as now, be it Jesus or our own lives, it's good to have those reminders of our humanity and finiteness, and a good incentive, as John Wesley used to say, to not trifle away the time. A few years ago, Stephen Levine published a little book called A Year to Live: How to Live This Year as If It Were Your Last. Through his therapy practice working with the terminally ill, he witnessed life-changing transformations in people who were told, "You have 6 months, a year at the most, to live." Once they got over the anger and denial, people began to look at life in a whole new way. Many felt liberated and energized. So he decided to try it for himself. He set a date 1 year in the future when he would die. Then he spent the days dealing with his rapidly decreasing opportunities to get life lived. He discovered that preparing to die was a great way to truly live, valuing every moment, squeezing every experience out of every opportunity. Carpe diem, with a vengeance. Talk about a deadline. So, for all of us, death can be the great motivator. And who of us knows for certain if we'll actually be around next New Year's. Myrrh is a reminder that we're finite. Life is even more precious than you think. Okay, so Christmas is behind us, and for many of us, tomorrow it's time to get back to our everyday living, the real world. But the new year can often leave us with this nagging feeling that we shouldn't be returning to our same old ways. Even the wise men had a dream that instructed them to work out a different route after their encounter with the Christ child. So, most of us at least take a stab at a resolution or two, but few get followed through on. Maybe this year, our resolutions could at least be influenced by the gifts of those wily sorcerers from Persia. Gold to remind us of the preciousness of relationships. Frankincense to remind us to heighten our awareness of the needs of those around us. And myrrh to remind us that we don't have a lot of time in this short life to be on about the work set before us. The good news is, committing ourselves to these resolutions is not simply an act of sheer willpower, but an act of cooperation with our companions on the journey. May we resolve to work out a different route this year, depending on one another, aware of one another, and by the power of the Spirit, not missing a single opportunity to celebrate the preciousness of life. Be well.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputlovefirst.org.